Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we discuss Lars von Trier's bleak, bizarre film, Melancholia. There's a strange meta quality to the film that consumes our conversation as we explore how the movie ultimately mirrors the human condition in the face of apocalypse.
Well, we're here to talk about a movie, but I just kind of feel
melancholy,
sad. Yeah.
Do you really? It's funny. Heading into this, I was like, "How do you introduce this movie? Like, what is Chris gonna say?" And like, you just had nothing.
I mean, my nothing was being melancholic.
Yeah. No,
wasn't a great Oscar-worthy performance on my part.
I believed it, so yeah, it was.
You heard the sigh at the beginning, right? Just that subtle, no words, just the sigh. That's a choice that I think is way beyond my experience level.
It was good acting, but I do have to inquire further because while you're putting on a show, while you're trying to act melancholic, my first reaction to what you were doing was like, oh, did this movie actually like kind of break you? Maybe not break you, but put you in that melancholic mood. Like, did this movie have that kind of effect on you?
Jumping right into it, aren't we?
Yeah.
Not as much the second time as it did the first time.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the first time? Guide me through the journey.
So I think I watched the movie for the first time. Man, I want to say I was in Ohio, but this came out in 2011. I left Ohio in 2013, but I thought this had been out for a while before I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little unsure of if I saw it when I was in Ohio, when I was in Iowa, or when I first got to Austin. But I remember being interested in it because I saw Another Earth before I saw this.
Yeah, I thought of that movie as where I was watching this movie.
It's just so funny to me that I don't know if there have been a movie that's existed that has like a planet coming closer to Earth and being in the visual plane of Earth in the modern era. Maybe like historically that was something that was done.
Mm-hmm.
But in the time I've been alive, I don't remember a movie doing it. And yet two happened to do it in the same year.
Oh, yeah. 2011. Wow, that's so funny. Like, Another Earth to me feels so 2011, but
yep.
Melancholia, I think it's just because Lars von Trier, we'll get into Lars von Trier, I guess, but I just feel like his movies, I love his movies, yet at the same time, like, I don't know how I feel about his movies, like, after I've watched them. I don't know how to describe it. And I think it's just because his movies are so bizarre and atypical of what I'm used to, that to me, they don't exist in a time and space, and like, they don't adhere to like how I typically watch movies and perceive movies and critique movies. They're just so strange that this movie could have been made, you could have told me any year and I would have believed it.
1942. I had never watched a Lars von Trier movie aside from Melancholia. So this is the only one I've ever watched.
Oh, wow. I went through a whole thing. I think early on in my movie watching career, I would like just sit down and pour through like all the big movies from people. So I watched like Dancer in the Dark and Dogville and, Europa, Breaking the Waves, I guess that was the big one. I was acquainted with his work, but it's funny thinking about his later stuff, Antichrist and On. I feel like he found a groove that settles more into like what I like. I feel like he really found his voice in a way that, like, Melancholia to me is perfect territory to start a Lars von Trier. Like, to me, this is when he's like at his best.
Nice. Apparently this is part of a Melancholia, is part of a trilogy.
Yeah.
Antichrist, Melancholia, and Nymphomaniac. That's interesting. Well, so I watch it and I loved it, but I was really like it, how it captured depression and the onset of depression and this kind of like episode really hit hard the first time I watched it, to the point where one of the reasons I haven't watched it in such a long time, like, it's, if it's not a decade, it's approaching a decade.
Okay.
Even though I was so impressed by the visuals and the style and the performances, was that it felt so heavy to me. But revisiting it, it was almost like, you know, the joke about monster movies, like, the monster is always scarier until you see it.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of had that effect, to where instead of being so heavy this time, I was actually laughing at it a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
Which is just very dark humor, but I think there's like a streak of dark humor in the movie.
I would agree with you.
So that was kind of a unique twist on the experience. But yeah, I was never watched a Lars von Trier movie, and then was very like impressed by the first time. But the second time, yeah, did it leave me in the emotional place that the first watching did?
Interesting. And do you want to like discuss what emotional place it left you in, or do you want to get into it as we talk about the movie?
I mean, on the first one, it was just that heaviness. Like, there was a sense of gravity, like a black hole had opened up, to keep with the theme of space. And I felt something a lot more existential and powerful. And I mean, I've never been diagnosed with depression. I've had, you know, circumstantial depressive episodes in college. Mm-hmm. You know, I liked a girl, we dated, she broke up with me out of nowhere, and I was crushed for months. Like, definitely, like, I'm saying it in a bit of a cheesy way, but it was actually like a psychological low point for me. Yeah. I was punching things, my hands were bloody all the time, like, not good. But and by punching things, not people, inanimate objects. But it's, so there was an emotional component that I recognized. And I think also just, you know, artists, like writers, tend to be a little more, I think, prone to episodes like that as well. Like, I myself am typically very social, but can in social situations, I think a lot of people feel this, that battery, once it's depleted,
mm-hmm.
you find yourself kind of like spiraling inward at times or looking for escape. So there was a lot of things that Justine was experiencing or demonstrating that were more intense or more exaggerated than what I felt, but they resonated. And that depiction on screen is something that I've never never experienced before, in such a way that was such a spiral. And you kind of, on that first viewing, I felt trapped with her in some ways, and trapped in that like depression and that pain. And the movie felt like so much longer. Like, if you had asked me prior to the second watch how long the movie was, I think I would have said 3 hours.
Yeah,
I was genuinely surprised when I saw that it was 2 hours and 10 minutes, which is still long, but it actually moved a lot faster to me this time.
Yeah, it doesn't feel long at all.
Yeah, so there was something in this second watch that didn't leave me quite in that same emotional place. There was more of a distance. There was more of a, like, entertainment rather than experience, which I did not expect.
That's funny. I mean, we can get into, like, my history of the movie, but I do want to dig into this a little bit first, because you reading like the black humor and how it isn't necessarily such a heavy movie. I love Lars von Trier, and I especially love the way he talks. I like his interviews and everything. And what I've gathered from his interviews is, like, this movie isn't necessarily about depression. He seems to have an attitude of, like, making a movie about depression, which he's had depressive episode. He suffers from depression. Like, he thinks that's, like, disgusting. Like, he can't fathom why anyone would make a movie about something so dark. So I think to him, this movie is more about melancholia, like the act of being melancholic, which there is, in my mind anyway, I mean, I'm no expert, but there's a big difference between being depressed, which is like clinically diagnosable, you know, like something that happens to somebody, something terrible happens to you and it sends you like down like this dark path. There's a difference between that and melancholia, which is this idea that it's the act of being melancholic. Like you are just kind of overwhelmed with the emptiness of the world and that there's beauty to be found in the world. And I think that's what more melancholia is. Like there's this longing to find a deeper meaning in something, but you're constantly just noticing all the hollowness that the world is. And to me, this movie captures that. And Lars von Trier talks about the act of melancholy in a humorous way. Like he is a melancholiac and he constantly notices all the empty rituals of the world. Like to him, that's why the wedding's in the movie, because it's this big giant empty ritual that Justine is throwing herself into because she thinks like, oh, if I just like do this thing that makes everyone else happy, I'll be happy. But you slowly see over the course of the wedding, like it's not doing what she think it will. And she's just stuck in the state she's in. He talks about going to parties and stuff and how he can't have fun at parties because like all he can notice is everyone around him just they're there to be happy. They think the act of being at a party will make them happy when really there's nothing but emptiness in a party. Like there's nothing deeper being retrieved from a party. There can be things like people, you can find that meaning, like people can go to parties for that, but he always sees his people not doing that. Like they're just kind of blindly getting through. And like it reminds me of at the end of the movie when Claire like wants to have wine, you know, on the lawn and have like a nice moment as the world's ending. Like she's clinging to the thing that she thinks will make her happy, but like the world's still going to end. You can't do anything about it. Like that to me is that's melancholia. And that's what he's trying to capture. And like, I do think there's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek black humorist attitude about that in the movie.
Yeah, just the way that you get the deconstruction of certain elements. Like, she deconstructs, I mean, not just the wedding, but her relationship. And as you're noting, like, getting into the idea that, what did they say? Like, hurt people, or you can't be in, like, a healthy relationship until you're in a good place. Like, these external things aren't going to solve whatever internal issues that there are.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you address those things, then it doesn't matter how many people you try to be friends with or how many people you date or the job that you have. If you're like unhappy because of something, you're not going to blindly move past it and just forget about it. It's something that maybe needs addressed a bit more. And seeing her try to go through these rituals, whether it's the job, the relationship, the marriage, and none of it working, and how much that sends her reeling, it does add like a little bit. Like when she quits and like tells off her boss, there's something pretty self-destructive but also funny about that.
Totally.
It's just the way she keeps leaving her wedding, it's also like self-destructive but kind of funny at a certain point. Like the way in which she is just all through Claire, what's the sister's portion, is also like, yeah, Claire, pretty funny to me as she's just once she's through like the beginning part of her depression, but she's like just kind of this wizened figure who's now disconnected from everything as everybody else freaks out.
Yeah.
It's like she went through her low point and now just has this disinterested distance to the whole thing.
Yeah, Volunteer spoke about that as well, and that like when you're a melancholiac, like you just all you notice is the hollowness, and you you're more prepared for disaster or when bad things happen because, like, all you see are the bad things. Like, all you notice is, like, all the stupid shit in the world. So I think that really explains her demeanor as the planet's approaching. Like, who cares if the world gets destroyed? The world was an evil place. Like, it's a good thing that this place is being destroyed where there's just nothing but suffering and empty rituals.
Bleak.
Yeah.
Bleak, which, bleak, bleak.
It's, and in that way, like, yes, it's bleak, but I also think to a melancholic, to somebody who sees the world that way, it's not bleak. Like, it's kind of a happy ending that all this stupid shit is being blown away. And to me, that's what makes the movie fascinating. Like, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance that's explored and that melancholia exists and then blind ritual exists. Like, these two things exist in the world. And there is a sort of middle ground of, because of course, in any ritual, you can find great meaning. Von Trier used this example of, you could think of a movie as that, where the plot is a ritual. Every movie needs a plot. And the ritual of, and the plot is just the ritual. Like, it's this thing that every movie does. It gets you through, blah, blah, blah. But if the movie isn't getting at something deeper that you connect to and you can reflect onto yourself and learn from, it's meaningless. Like, it's a hollow movie. But if the movie's able to actually achieve this thing, like, well, we've allowed this ritual to gain meaning. So I think that's an interesting part of the movie, is we're seeing these two extremes on each end. And at first, we get to watch Justine's character, like, go through her extreme of, like, she just cannot make herself normal for the world. She can't be a husband to Alexander Skarsgård, or a wife to Alexander Skarsgård in the way. Maybe she could be a husband if she really wanted to. But and then when we go to Claire's part, she's unable to deal with the reality that the world could end, that all of this, you know, all the riches and everything you thought you were doing for your life that was good and sensible, like, didn't matter because it can all go away in an instant. The movie explores those two extremes. And I think it makes the movie a very, like, artistic in that way, you know? Yep. Like, it's more of a statement about life and, like, a state of being more than I don't think the movie is necessarily arguing that, like, oh, like, the world should end and, like, melancholia is, like, the way to go. I think it's just kind of exploring that we all deal with this. Like, we all know that feeling of melancholy and how it can overtake you and how we perform these rituals maybe to push it away. And it's just kind of capturing the human condition in that way.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Yeah, there's something to the movie, if you view it literally, which I think is what I mean, obviously there's the very figurative element, especially with the planet called Melancholia. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it as more literal in the sense that the depression wins and everything ends, you could view it as very glass half empty, in a way, like, very tragic. But there's also, when you're looking at it as just more on the metaphorical level, is that this doesn't signify the actual end of life or end of the world, but signifies just the way in which people navigate disaster in their lives and the different kinds of reaction to disaster in your life. It's not necessarily about a story that ends so much as it is about the process and the way in which we go through these things, yeah, deal with these things, confront these things, and the different ways in which we see people trying to have control or let go of control. And I think it becomes very interesting to look at the aftermath of the movie. I mean, obviously in the movie, the planet's destroyed. But mm-hmm. if you were to look at what does Claire do next? What does Justine do next in the much more metaphorical sense is like the planet didn't get destroyed. They just had these very bad episodes when it came to their panic and the things that kind of eat at them and gnaw at them. What's next for Justine? Does she start a new job? Can she start a new relationship? Is that where she goes? Does she find another like direction for herself that's a little more... I guess what I'm trying to say is that the movie almost operates like a loss of innocence story, if you're sure. looking at it as a glass half full style, and that having experienced what they've all experienced, they might come through it on the other end, on the other side of disaster, as like, all right, so what is next? There's a little bit more of the philosophical route you can go down that extends beyond just everybody dies.
Yeah. I think that pretty much captures Lars von Trier's mentality when it comes to movies. Like, I do think he's always trying to make a philosophical statement. And it's he strikes, again, he's just got the most interesting aesthetic. Like, he still is able to paint interesting characters and like give them life and personality and everything, but in that sense they kind of are, they're just representations of like different parts of the human psyche. I mean, a lot of directors do that. I just watched The Seventh Seal, and to me, like, that whole movie is nothing but that, like, grappling with the end of the world and like what's on the other side and being unable to handle death. Like, every character in that movie is just different parts of Ingmar Bergman's persona. And that's, I guess that's how I'm viewing a lot of his movies. And I feel like what you're describing about this movie, like, every character is just different ways to think about the world and how you can either make yourself blind to something or just be completely overwhelmed by it and incapacitated by it. And in that way, the movie, like, gains, it has its own life in a way that, like, all of these characters are just the pulsating parts of reality and how tough it is to be human.
Yeah, very well said. Well, so how did your second viewing, was this your second viewing?
It's my third viewing.
Third? How's the progression been for you?
It's been good. I will say that when I watched it early on, I don't think I, not that I didn't like it, but in my mind, like, it wasn't as good as von Trier's other material. Like, I remember really loving Breaking the Waves and Dancer in the Dark, and thinking that those were just, they're a little more, like, hardcore, kind of. Like, they're kind of, like, in your face, and they're just, like, more independent, I guess, is more what it is. And Melancholia is, like, kind of polished. Like, it almost, even though it is really bizarre and philosophical, like, it feels like I had a budget, and it has all these, like, great actresses in it, and it feels polished in that way. I actually read something from von Trier that he was a little sickened by how polished it was. Because I think he wanted to make a movie that was more like, it's about melancholy and depression. Like, he wanted it to be a little more hardcore, and it actually has like flair to it. I don't know. I actually didn't really grapple what he was trying to say, but I also sort of understood it. So I think that's how I kind of felt about the movie at the time, is like, it just wasn't as cool as his old movies. And I'm looking at my ratings now. I watched it back in 2012, and that was right when I was watching all of his other movies. But I watched it again, I think maybe last year. I think Lauren and I watched it just randomly. I don't even know why we did. And I just was very taken by it. Like, I had recently watched Nymphomaniac, and Nymphomaniac instantly became like one of my favorite movies. So I was really excited to watch Melancholy again. And I don't think it reaches those heights for me personally, but I still, like, I connected with it in a way I was ready for, and was suddenly like, okay, like, modern von Trier is like where it's at. And have since then watched The House that Jack Built and loved it. So came to it again this third time, like already loving it, and probably felt the same way about it, like really connected with it, like it a lot. I think there are maybe a couple things that keep it from being like an all-time great for me, but still really a really unique movie in the way it just dissects depression and melancholy, like how the way it explores like just that state of being is, I don't know if I've seen another movie like this.
Yeah. I, you know, it's funny you say the things that keep it from being like top tier.
Yeah.
I think that was the thing that I was kind of grappling with and surprised by, is that I think I expected this to go, when we ranked it, into my favorites list, and I'm not sure that it does.
Yeah.
I think the thing that actually surprised me was how much smaller the film felt to me on the second watch. Visually, I mean, you still have some great visuals, but it's like all the kind of surreal, powerful things that I remembered didn't quite have the same lifespan that I thought that they did, or the same like palpable presence. You get that bit at the very beginning, and that's really it for a lot of the movie, until you finally start seeing like melancholia in the distance. And it's a really cool shot, and the ending's also like very cool, but I just remember there being like a little more of the pedal going to the floor in terms of just what it was accelerating to, what it was building up to, and the payoff to all of that. Where on this watch, as I was like waiting and waiting, I was like, oh, that's it, that's it, that's it. Okay. Like in some ways it felt like another Earth, but with a much like larger budget. I guess it's not like a much larger budget. $9.4 million for this.
Yes, and not big at all.
Another Earth had a budget of, I mean, I can't imagine. It was $1.9 million.
Yeah, it's probably pretty small.
Oh no, that was the box office. I don't even know what the budget was then. Oh, 100,000.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's really small.
So it's like some of the shots in Another Earth are done for $100,000, and you get about as much like cinematic flair in that as you do in Melancholia, which is, you know, 900 times more expensive.
I mean, if you're just talking about the planets part, I guess I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's like, I mean, yeah, like the setting, the castle and everything, like it's,
and just like the handheld camera, like to me, that was a cool part of the movie. I noticed this time is like, that's what I expect from Von Trier. Like he's stripping away like the beauty of something. Like, yeah, you're at this castle, but there's something gritty about the way you're exploring it, you know?
Yeah, I made me immediately think when I saw the handheld camera of Inland Empire.
Oh yeah.
And just how much more to Von Trier's, I guess, hatred, polished the use of the handheld is in this.
Yeah.
Versus in Inland Empire, where it really feels like somebody got a camera from Radio Shack and is just like filming people in a room.
Well, Lynch was going for that feel, I think.
Yeah, very much so. But it's just having experienced Inland Empire and what that can see in terms of like the floor of a handheld camera, I thought this was a nice a nice middle ground. But yeah, I was just a little more disappointed in the scope of the visuals. Like it's still like a beautiful movie start to finish, and like very interestingly shot. It's just all the kind of like next level stuff that I remember being so excited about didn't quite have the same shine this time.
I know what you mean. I still think the movie is really beautiful, and I do at one point want to talk about the opening of the movie, because I think that is spectacular as far as visually going. But I have just like, as I sat down to talk to you for this, I was sitting here like, I still don't know how I feel about this. Like, how am I going to talk about this movie? I keep like racing through a lot of thoughts. But this watch, especially since after recently watching Nymphomaniac and The House That Jack Built, and like realizing just looking at just how those movies are shot and the visual poetry of them, be able to grasp a little bit more what isn't quite hitting about Melancholy. Because, like, again, I really connect to the point of the movie, the aesthetic of the movie, what it's going for. But I almost feel like on some level, it's inherently not flawed, but, like, only capable to achieve so much for me personally. Like, as I said earlier, I think von Trier is trying to find... He's trying to visually display the sort of cognitive dissonance that goes on with any human being that's grappling between, like, ritual and melancholy and trying to find happiness in a world that largely is filled with bullshit. Like, it's the movie, it's split between two parts, like, literally between, like, one woman who's just completely overtaken by melancholy and one woman who's, like, trying to blindly look past it and thinks, like, Justine needs to just man up and get over it. I think the movie... just inherently in that way comes to signify that battle. And it, you know, at the beginning of the movie, when it shows all of those images, von Trier is basically just, he's trying to remove the ritual, you know, the plot. He tells you that the world ends. He removes that aspect from the movie. Like, you head into the movie knowing all these things about the characters from these, like, painting, like, images he's given of you, like Claire's feet sinking into the ground and Justine floating in the river. Like, you get these senses about them, like, you know so much about them and you already have this context for the situations we're soon going to see them in, you know, like, he's given these very, like, artistic reimaginings of them. So, like, you head into the movie, like, knowing a lot. And by doing that, I feel like von Trier is trying to strip away the ritual, in a sense, and just thrust you into, like, what is and what is real about being this way. And in that way, he kind of removes a lot of the beauty that I personally really like about the ritual of movies. Like, I like going through all those things, like, slowly piecing together the themes and all that. But I do think it's interesting to approach a movie the way von Trier did. And I think that's maybe as far as I can go with it. Like, it's a really interesting way to approach this topic and these kinds of people. But I feel like the way he did it, like, he did it in this very artistic way. He did it to make a statement, like, almost like it's an exhibit at a museum or something. But by removing, like, all the things I like about a movie, I feel like maybe he's diminished how much I can connect with it. Even though that's the point. And by me saying that, I'm feeding into his point about, like, how we need the ritual. But I guess I'm saying in the end, like, I kind of like the ritual.
Yeah, not all rituals bad, you know? It's funny how we have different, like, the same conclusion, but different reasoning. Uh-huh. Like, for me, it's just, it doesn't go far enough with some of those visual elements and, like, how weird it gets. Like, the promise of that opening scene vanishes for a lot of the film until you get to the very end and some of the weird stuff starts happening. Like, I kept thinking about Donnie Darko. Mm-hmm. I feel like this movie and Donnie Darko are actually very spiritually similar.
Sure.
Like, kind of in some ways the same movie.
Yeah, they are in a lot of ways.
One a little more, like, glass half empty and one a little more glass half full. But, like, Donnie Darko, I think it has that initial promise of some of the, like, stranger, more fantastical elements, and you get those sprinkled throughout the movie, you get more of a payoff on them, and I think I wanted just a little bit more of that. Another one that, for some reason, is coming to mind is Sorry to Bother You. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I did.
The twist in that is so insane to me. Uh-huh. But there's such a continued escalation and payoff throughout the film, and not just in, like, a very small way, that I just keep thinking about maybe this just needed a little bit more.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have it, like, a C plot, a D plot, like, just something else. And I didn't get that.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I definitely don't need those things. And I mean, everything you're describing, again, I feel like von Trier just actively was like, I'm not doing any of that stuff. Like, he just wanted a very, like, straightforward, kind of stripped of, just like, there's no flair, really. Like, there is flair in the sense, like, you see, like, the planets and stuff, and there are these big, beautiful shots of the garden. Like, there's beauty in the movie visually, but he almost is purposely removing beauty from it in a sense. Like, he doesn't want all of those things you're describing in there. He kind of wants you to just steep in what is. And I really respect that, but I don't necessarily need all the things you're describing, but I do also think at the same time, respect is kind of the furthest I can go with it. As far as, like, the presentation of it, I feel like he could have done it in a way that better, I mean, I don't mean the armchair quarterback him, like, I tell him how to make the movie or anything, but me personally, I feel like there could have been more of a, I guess, more of a flair. Like, I don't necessarily need, like, more plot, like... I feel like maybe that's what you're getting at a little bit, where, like, sorry to bother you, like, just, like, keeps throwing, like, curveballs at you, and you're like, oh, this is what the movie's doing. Like, I don't necessarily need that, but I do think there's just something... All I can do is really think about Nymphomaniac and The House of Jack Built. Like, to me, those movies, like, go there. They do these things, I'm like, oh, shit. Like, this movie is on a different level philosophically, without needing to, like, twist the plot and make it something beyond what it is, if any of that makes sense.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, I think I just wanted more, like, not necessarily even plot, but just more of, like, the fantastical to have, like, a little bit more room to breathe.
Yeah,
but,
right.
There are a few things that I did, like, really love, in no specific order, but just kind of what they're jumping to mind. When she sleeps with Leo on the golf course,
yeah,
I love the fact that von Trier keeps it as, like, a long shot, a wide shot, away from the characters, because for Justine, it's a very dispassionate act. It's not something she's doing out of any sense of passion. And so keeping the camera at a distance kind of lends it that sense of distance and disconnect that she's feeling towards the act,
mm-hmm.
as it's just something purely self-destructive to do.
Yeah.
Like, to cross a bridge and know that there's no turning back from it. So I really like the nuance of that choice. It's a small thing that I don't think a lot of people would necessarily be like, oh, I get why he did that. But it's one of those choices that adds that emotional subtext to it, or that psychological subtext to it, that's really great. The other thing was that I'm somebody that believes that more films need to front load information and allow us to have the knowledge and then be curious about what the characters are doing. I think a lot of movies that rely on mystery or twists don't have a lot of rewatch value because they hide the information from the viewer, and sometimes characters in the film have the information, and so the big thing for the viewer is just like, what's actually going on? What's actually going on? And then once you know, you're just kind of like, okay, that's
right.
Hateful Eight is the movie that jumps to mind when I think about that, because there's so much of like, what is going to happen? What is going to happen? And then the twist happens. And you're just like, that's it. Like, that's all. Okay. It takes out all of the tension from the movie for me from then on, where if the movie had started linearly with that scene that we end up flashing back to for the twist,
mm-hmm.
I would have been so much more interested in knowing, like, all right, this thing is like the bomb is there. That's what Hitchcock did a lot of, right?
Sure, yeah.
You would see a character put a bomb under a car, and then people get in the car and go driving around, and you're just sitting there with the tension of, like, I know the bomb's there. The characters don't know the bomb's there. When's the bomb going to go off? When's the bomb going to go off? When's the bomb going to go off? That is really cool to me. So Von Trier had a quote that said, in a James Bond movie, we expect the hero to survive. It can get exciting nonetheless, and some things may be thrilling precisely because we know what's going to happen, but not how they will happen. In Melancholia, it's interesting to see how the characters we follow react as the planet approaches Earth. And that was him talking about the fact that we as the audience at the very beginning know that the planets collide.
Yeah, right.
So what's that mean when all of this is going on and kind of framing everything? I really love that choice. Part of me also, I think, wonders if the opening scene is a vision that Justine's having. And is how she kind of knows where events are going to go, how she knows the world's going to end. Like, I was thinking about that, and actually when the movie ended, went back to the start of it. And you kind of get like that close up on her face, her eyes opening at the very beginning, which could, it just could be like a very disconnected, non-diegetic thing that the movie's showing us as preparation for what happens, almost like a preview of things to come. But given Justine saying that she knows what's going to happen and has this idea, is there a point in the movie where she mentions kind of being in her wedding dress and dragging these black tendrils?
Yeah. I wrote down that quote because I really liked it. I'm trudging through gray woolly yarn. It's clinging to my legs. It's really heavy to drag along.
Yeah, that's from the opening.
Yes.
So either the movie is, either that opening is kind of just previewing everything or summarizing the things, or that's what she saw. And then we're hearing her describe it later, and it kind of serves as this like dream sequence. And part of the reason why she's like having such a hard time at her wedding is because she knows what's about to happen.
That's interesting. I would argue that both are happening. Here, and I got this quote from Von Trier because he talks about the opening of the movie. I've always liked the idea of an overture, that you strike some themes. And typically, we would have made an image of special effects. We would have made an image of special effects of something we found would happen at such a collision. This is very weirdly worded. Even though the plot itself just hints at the disaster in close-ups. I thought it would be fun to take the images out of context and begin with them instead. That gets rid of the aesthetic in one full blow. Which I think is interesting. Like, I feel like I get what he's saying. That, again, you just remove, like, the what you expect movies to do by just, like, telling you everything at the beginning. And in that way, I think he, I feel like he just strips away like all of the stuff he thinks is bullshit in the movie and just kind of thrust you into like what the movie is. But at the same time, I like the idea of it being Justine's vision, because he wrote, basically when he wrote the character of Justine, he was writing himself. Like, he was just writing her in the way he saw the world and how difficult it is for him to like go to a wedding, basically, you know, that kind of stuff. So since they're spiritually connected in that way, it almost like the movie is, like the beginning of the movie is her vision, because it is just the way Von Trier is like picturing these characters and what they're going through. And someone who's a melancholic just sees through the bullshit and sees the hollowness of what is and viscerally feels all of the hard things about life. So I think that's what he's expressing here at the beginning of the movie, is just how difficult it is to be these people and what they're going through. And in that way, it's kind of what, it's just how Justine already sees the world. She might as well have seen it in a vision.
That's true. I do like that connection with Von Trier and kind of that meta element of he's Justine. He had a vision for the movie. Justine also has essentially the vision of the movie.
Right.
and grappling with that. It's funny too, because you do then have what could be viewed as like a strange subplot with her boss, and the boss hounding her for, what was it, the tagline that he wants?
Yeah.
She was like the marketing director.
Yeah.
And so he keeps like pestering her for the tagline, which is this kind of creative thing, like trying to get this idea, this inspiration from her and hyping up her genius and ability with it. You can almost start to view the movie in some ways as, I mean, almost about like the creative process in a way. And Von Trier grappling with his own work and ability to work and like story ideation and creation and what that demands from him, what that takes out of him, the process of it. So there's kind of a potentially a subtextual layer of that, of just like the act of creation.
Sure. That's really cool. I like that.
Hmm.
I will say really quick what maybe my favorite part of the movie, not really my favorite, but the part that gave me the most joy and made me wish like there was more of this in it was, I mean, Udo Kier is in this movie, who I absolutely love. He's the wedding planner. He's just one of the best character actors ever. And I just love him in this movie. I think he's hilarious. And when he like refuses to look at Justine because he ruined her wedding, and every time he walks by her, he puts his hand up so he can't see her.
Yeah.
It was making me laugh pretty hard.
Yeah. It's just the one, like when he's going by in the party and just hand over his face. And he's also the one that talks about the beans, right?
Yeah, the beans.
He's like, there's 686 beans.
Yeah.
She's like, what?
The people of the party will want to know who won.
No, they don't.
And then Justine knows how many beans are in there.
Yeah. How did she know? Kiefer Sutherland, I never watched 24.
I haven't seen it either.
I don't think I've ever actually watched him in anything other than this. That's impossible, right?
I've seen him. I mean, I haven't seen him in a ton of things, but I've mostly seen him in like older movies.
I mean, I didn't watch Twin Peaks.
Here, let's pull up his.
Dark City, I saw in college, but don't remember like a single thing about. Phone Booth, okay. I should remember Phone Booth.
I don't remember him in Phone Booth.
He's the caller.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, that's right. Of course. Yeah.
But I always forget that his voice is as deep as it is.
Uh-huh.
So that like jarred me every time he talked. I was just like, oh, man. Kiefer's voice. It's funny how much this also kind of reminded me of Succession. It could feel like an episode of Succession, just with how the mom was, how kind of disconnected the dad was. It has a very Succession-y aesthetic as well. And Alexander Skarsgård is in both.
Interesting. Yeah, another show I have not seen.
Yeah. Succession heads will get it. They'll be like, yes, Chris, great point.
It's funny. Whenever I think of Kiefer Sutherland, I just think of the movie Flatliners. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's the most 90s movie ever. It's a Joel Schumacher movie. And it's just about these people who flatline, you know. They go on the verge of, they die so they can enter like this, the limbo, and they go into this weird realm, and then their friends have to bring them back to life, you know, at the right moment before they actually die.
It reminds me of something that we did in like sixth grade. You would like put each other in headlocks until we kind of like started to pass out, like brown out.
You guys had fun doing this?
For like 2 weeks, and then we're just like, this is dumb, isn't it?
For 2 weeks?
Yeah.
I would hope that would end after like 5 minutes.
It wasn't like it was happening a lot. It was like one person did it on recess, and you're just like, oh my goodness. And then the next day, somebody else would like try to do it, and you're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Every day I get another piece of the Chris puzzle.
Yeah. I think my one friend was like faking it a lot for attention. but he was the one like often volunteering. He's like, do it to me, and he'd like flop over.
Have you checked in on that guy, by the way? Is he still doing okay?
Last time I saw him, he was on Massling Court TV. he had been arrested and was being sentenced for jail.
Oh, man. Well, you know.
I mean, so maybe the brain cells, brain cell damage was
real. You might have done that.
Oh, no. So, Melancholia, I forget how we got there, but... No.
We were talking about Kiefer Sutherland. By the way, I'm looking at the Letterboxd page. He's been in 102 movies, which is pretty crazy. And I've seen 9 of them.
I guess I've seen like 2 or 3. it's... His character takes such a like a chicken shit way out.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty gross
the way
he just abandons his family.
Well, again, though, you're reading into the dark humor of the movie. Like, I view that as like a funny moment almost. Not that, like, obviously suicide is not funny, but the fact that he's like, he's so sure of himself and is such, like, he's just so annoying and how sure of himself he is and how the way everyone else should be. And like, just listen to me. I know what's right, blah, blah, blah. And then for the second, for it all to be bullshit, he just takes his own life because he can't deal with the way reality actually is. Like, to me, that's just a moment where Von Trier is chuckling to himself as he writes it down.
When it gets at the exploration, like the kaleidoscopic aspect of how people are responding to Melancholia, right? Like, he was trying to have control. He was putting on a brave face for a lot of the movie. So his way of dealing with his stress, his anxiety, his grief, was to try to like tell others how to be, what to be, how to think, like try to have this sense of control and hide everything, versus Justine, who's just like lets it all out there.
Yeah.
Versus Claire, who really like, I feel like Claire's a little less defined than Justine in terms of her panic, or does it at least get the same treatment? But there is kind of that like pretending that things are all right in a different way than Kiefer Sutherland's character.
Right.
But that you have the different ways in which they're dealing with Melancholia. So all three are very like important pieces. Even Alexander Skarsgård's character and the way in which he deals with Justine, like trying to put on this brave face, like trying to be patient, trying to accept blame, but also like not dealing well and eventually just like walking out.
Yeah. Like Claire says something to Justine at some point, like, you can't let Michael know who you really are. Like, you have to keep trying to like get past this melancholy and be a normal person. And Justine's like, I know I need to do it. And Michael leaving is basically the acknowledgement of that. Like, I think he just realizes that she's a lost cause, that this estate he's going to buy her can't cure her sadness. And it's just him giving up on it.
Yeah. I wonder, like, I doubt he saw her on the golf course, but we see him looking out the window a few times, like he was keeping tabs on her. I feel like if he saw her with Leo, he probably would have been a bit more angry, but the rejection he was feeling was definitely real.
It was a combination of that, and I think the fact that Justine told off his father in real life, but his boss in the movie, Stellan Skarsgård, after he told him off, after she told him off, Michael kind of follows suit. Like, he also leaves with the boss because the whole reason they were together in the first place is like they were just connected through work. And the fact that she turned her back on work and insulted his boss like was too much for him. Like, to me, that's just a Von Trier's artistically way of painting the situation of like she's just unable to be part of this work world, and now this regular work world is turning her back on her in the form of Michael. Like, he can't handle the way she can't even like come up with a tagline, so like, I can't really be with her.
There's definitely that aspect of, okay, it already seems like she's being self-destructive with like me, and now she's like, I mean, Michael or the boss was the best man.
Yeah, right.
So it's like they're obviously close, and the fact that she's already being weird towards him and now like essentially calling off his best friend.
Yeah.
Or calling out his best friend and being so shitty, it's yeah. It's the dominoes are falling.
Yes.
Anything else?
No. I still think it's a really interesting movie. Like, I like it a lot. I just wish I could like it more.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Where I went in thinking that this was going to be one that I was, like, gushing over, I came out just, like, a little more, not lukewarm, but cooler on than
yeah.
what I expected. But I do want to say the hot take of this is a better space movie than Interstellar.
Most space movies are better space movies than Interstellar.
It's just the thing that gets me about Interstellar is that you barely have any space shots aside from just being inside the ship, and then you get to a black hole at one point and the shot of the black hole is spectacular, but it lasts like 2 seconds, and then it goes back to the interior of the ship and then some close-ups of the ship like in the black hole, but you don't really get a sense of space.
Right.
You don't really get this sense of epic visuals. They make for great still images that you can share on social media, but it's not a great cinematography across the movie that you can dive into the way that you can with 2001 or even this or Another Earth. I think the use of celestial elements is so much better in this than in Interstellar, and you don't even go into space in this movie.
Yeah. I'm just nodding my head in agreement. All right, we're going to rank
this guy?
That was my
last thing. Yeah, let's rank this.
Okay, for all those uninitiated, we have a big grand ranking of all the movies we've watched in the past year / year and a half. My list is a little longer, partly because I have no life and do nothing but watch movies, but I also started my list a little earlier than Chris. Right now, my list is up to 505 movies.
Whew. That's a good amount of movies.
And Melancholia is, it was a lot higher, not a lot higher, but it was a little bit higher before coming into today, because I did watch it in the last year, so I had it ranked. I moved down the ranking. I think it was at number like 110-ish, and I moved it down to 160.
Oh man. Okay, so it dropped that
like,
many positions.
Still in like great company. Like it's in my mind, it's still just near a bunch of amazing movies. So there's just a lot of movies on the list, so it could maybe sound like it's a huge drop, but it wasn't really.
What do you have Blade Runner 2049 at?
2049? Let me go down to the bottom of the list here. 465.
Okay, I was trying to figure out, I hadn't put this on the list yet, and I'm trying to figure out where I'm putting it.
Let me offer up my sandwich really quick while you're going through that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At the top of the sandwich, we have Saboteur, which, hey, we're talking about Alfred Hitchcock. That's a Hitchcock movie from 1942. Then Blade. Hey, I like this sandwich. Then Melancholia. Then Parents, which is like, it's an 80s horror movie about this kid. This little kid, like this little boy who finds out his parents are like killing people and eating people.
Oh.
It's pretty good. And then The Squid and the Whale.
Okay. That's quite the sandwich.
It's a really weird sandwich. But, you know, I like an eclectic sandwich. It has lots of different toppings on it.
Yeah. It's like you have anchovies and peanut butter.
Yeah.
I'm up to 174 movies since July of 2022, and I have Melancholia. This is subject to change. I have it right now in the impressive category, which is like, you know, 10, 9, 8, I guess. Out of the 10 categories, it's number 8 in terms of the level. I could see it going up, but I currently have it at 44 overall, and the sandwich above it, 42 is After Sun, 43 is Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, then Melancholia, and then 45 is Blade Runner 2049, and then 46 is Saltburn. But I could see bumping this up as I'm sitting with it. I also have Napoleon at number 48, and I think I might be bumping that up as well.
You started to say Napoleon, and I thought you were going to say Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, no.
Which I guess I don't have a problem with, but I was just like, it just made me think of that movie for the first time in like 10 years.
When I watched that, I only watched it one time in high school, and I was not a fan.
I wasn't really either, but I kind of want to watch it again. Like, I just for the sake of like transporting myself back to 2004 or whenever it came out.
Nice. Yeah, so currently 44, but with the potential to rise.
Yeah, gosh, I'm kind of in the same boat that like I could see myself moving. It's just, it depends what day you ask me. Like today, when the things I'm thinking about I don't like the movie bring it down, but if I was really focusing on the things I like about the movie and I was feeling very melancholic one day, maybe I would bump it up. But for now, that's where it's at.
Yeah, it's like typically I think I'd put it in the wow category because it does have like a sense of epic about it, but also it's so actually small.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah.
Well, okay. Well, Chris, we're at the end of the show, which means I now get to pick the next movie.
Yeah.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to double the amount of Lars von Trier movies you've watched.
Oh. Beautiful.
I'm going to choose The House That Jack Built.
Okay.
I watched it just a few months ago, and it was the kind of movie where the second I watched it, I wanted to watch it immediately again. Time doesn't necessarily permit me to do that anymore, but I was just like very anxious. I think I get this movie. I really want to love it more than I do, but like, I think I need another viewing to like fully grasp it. So this is my chance to do that.
Okay. I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm really interested to hear what you'll say. More than anything, I just want to talk through it. I feel like talking through Melancholy was good.
Okay. Well, I will definitely have thoughts. That's for sure.
Yay.
Perfect.
All right. You ready to end this?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody's watching us. Like, I'm looking over at everybody. They're quiet. They're just like, eyes are wide, and they're dripping with anticipation over here. Okay, you ready?
Yeah. Okay. Dripping with anticipation.
Sure. Lights.
Camera.
See ya.
See ya.
Yeah.
I think we did it that time.